hit her a couple of licks and her making that dumb show of hers to try to get me stopped, but I had my duty and I kept on hitting. If I did enough of it, I figured, I'd knock it out of her. That was when she put the hex on me, just like she did on Roy and Butcher, but in a different way. She turned me blind. She blinded her own father. I couldn't see a thing. I just stumbled around the yard yelling and clawing at my eyes, and then they got all right again, but she was gone. I saw her running through the woods and up the hill, so Roy and me, we took out after her.
And you think I have her here?
I know you have, said Hank.
Okay, said Enoch.
Have a look around.
You can bet I will, Hank told him grimly.
Roy, take the barn. She might be hiding there.
Roy headed for the barn. Hank went into the shed, came out almost immediately, strode down to the sagging chicken house. Enoch stood and waited, the rifle cradled on his arm. He had trouble here, he knew, more trouble than he'd ever had before. There was no such thing as reasoning with a man of Hank Fisher's stripe. There was no approach, right now, that he would understand. All that he could do, he knew, was to wait until Hank's temper had cooled off. Then there might be an outside chance of talking sense to him. The two of them came back.
She ain't nowhere around, said Hank. She is in the house.
Enoch shook his head. There can't anyone get into that house.
Roy, said Hank, climb them there steps and open up that door.
Roy looked fearfully at Enoch.
Go ahead, said Enoch.
Roy moved forward slowly and went up the steps. He crossed the porch and put his hand upon the front doorknob and turned. He tried again. He turned around.
Pa, he said, I can't turn it. I can't get it open.
Hell, said Hank, disgusted. You can't do anything.
Hank took the steps in two jumps, paced wrathfully across the porch. His hand reached out and grasped the knob and wrenched at it powerfully. He tried again, and yet again. He turned angrily to face Enoch.
What is going on here? He yelled.
I told you, Enoch said,
that you can't get in. The hell I can't, roared Hank.
He tossed the whip to Roy and came down off the porch, striding over to the woodpile that stood beside the shed. He wrenched the heavy, double-bitted axe out of the chopping block.
Careful with that axe, warned Enoch. I've had it for a long time, and I set a store by it.
Hank did not answer. He went up on the porch and squared off before the door.
Stand off, he said to Roy. Give me elbow room.
Roy backed away.
Wait a minute, Enoch said. You mean to chop down that door?
You're damned right I do.
Enoch nodded gravely.
Well? Asked Hank.
It's all right with me if you want to try.
Hank took his stance, gripping the handle of the axe. The steel flashed swiftly, up over his shoulder, then down in a driven blow.
The edge of the steel struck the surface of the door and turned, deflected by the surface, changed its course, bouncing from the door. The blade came slicing down and back. It missed Hank's spraddled leg by no more than an inch, and the momentum of it spun him half around. He stood there, foolishly, arms outstretched, hands still gripping the handle of the axe. He stared at Enoch.
Try again, invited Enoch.
Rage flowed over Hank. His face was flushed with anger.
By God, I will,
he yelled. He squared off again, and this time he swung the axe not at the door, but at the windows set beside the door. The blade struck, and there was a high singing sound as pieces of sun-bright steel went flying through the air. Ducking away, Hank dropped the axe. It fell to the floor of the porch and bounced. One blade was broken, the metal sheared away in jagged breaks. The window was intact. There was not a scratch upon it. Hank stood there for a moment, staring at the broken axe as if he could not quite believe it. Silently, he stretched out his hand, and Roy put the bullwhip in it. The two of them came down the stairs. They stopped at the bottom of them and looked at Enoch. Hank's hand twitched on the whip.
If I were you, said Enoch, I wouldn't try it, Hank. I can move awfully fast.
He patted the gun butt.
I'd have the hand off you before you could swing that whip.
Hank breathed heavily.
There's the devil in you, Wallace, he said. And there's the devil in her, too. You're working together. The two of you, sneaking around in the woods, meeting one another.
Enoch waited, watching the both of them.
God help me, cried Hank. My own daughter is a witch.
I think, said Enoch, you should go back home. If I happen to find Lucy, I will bring her there. Neither of them made a move.
You haven't heard the last of this, yelled Hank. You have my daughter somewhere, and I'll get you for it.
Anytime you want, said Enoch, but not now. He made an imperative gesture with the rifle barrel. Get moving, he said, and don't come back, either one of you. They hesitated for a moment, looking at him, trying to gauge him, trying to guess what he might do next. Slowly they turned, and walking side by side, moved off down the hill. Chapter 18. He should have killed the two of them, he thought. They were not fit to live. He glanced down at the rifle and saw that his hands had such a tense grip on the gun that his fingers stood out white and stiff against the satin brownness of the wood. He gasped a little in his effort to fight down the rage that boiled inside him, trying to explode. If they had stayed here any longer, if he'd not run them off, he knew he'd have given in to that towering rage. And it was better, much better, the way that it had been. He wondered a little dully how he had managed to hold in, and was glad he had, for even as it stood, it would be bad enough. They would say he was a madman, that he had run them off at gunpoint. They might even say that he had kidnapped Lucy and was holding her against her will. They would stop at nothing to make him all the trouble that they could. He had no illusions about what they might do, for he knew the breed, vindictive in their smallness, little vicious insects of the human race. He stood beside the porch and watched them down the hill, wondering how a girl so fine as Lucy could spring from such decadent stock. Perhaps her handicap had served as a bulwark against the kind of folks they were, had kept her from becoming another one of them. Perhaps, if she could have talked with them or listened, she would in time have become as shiftless and as vicious as any one of them. It had been a great mistake to get mixed up in a thing like this. A man in his position had no business in an involvement such as this. He had too much to lose. He should have stood aside. And yet, what could he have done? Could he have refused to give Lucy his protection, with the blood soaking through her dress from the lashes that lay across her shoulders? Should he have ignored the frantic, helpless pleading in her face? He might have done it differently, he thought. There might have been other, smarter ways in which to handle it, but there had been no time to think of any smarter way. There only had been time to carry her to safety and then go outside to meet them. And now that he thought of it, perhaps the best thing would have been not to go outside at all. If he'd stayed inside the station, nothing would have happened. It had been impulsive, that going out to face them. It had been, perhaps, the human thing to do, but it had not been wise. But he had done it, and it was over now, and there was no turning back. If he had to do it again, he would do it differently, but you got no second chance. He turned heavily around and went back inside the station. Lucy was still sitting on the sofa, and she held a flashing object in her hand. She was staring at it raptly, and there was in her face again that same vibrant and alert expression he had seen that morning when she'd held the butterfly. He laid the rifle on the desk and stood quietly there, but she must have caught the motion of him, for she looked quickly up, and then her eyes once more went back to the flashing thing she was holding in her hands. He saw that it was the pyramid of spheres, and now all the spheres were spinning slowly, in alternating clockwise and counterclockwise motions, and that as they spun, they shone and glittered, each of its own particular color, as if there might be, deep inside each one of them, a source of soft, warm light. Enoch caught his breath at the beauty and the wonder of it, the old, hard wonder of what this thing might be and what it might be meant to do. He had examined it 100 times or more, and had puzzled at it, and there had been nothing he could find that was of significance. So far as he could see, it was only something that was meant to be looked at, although there had been that persistent feeling that it had a purpose, and that, perhaps somehow, it was meant to operate. And now it was in operation. He had tried 100 times to get it figured out, and Lucy had picked it up just once and had got it figured out. He noticed the rapture with which she was regarding it. Was it possible, he wondered, that she knew its purpose? He went across the room and touched her arm, and she lifted her face to look at him, and in her eyes he saw the gleam of happiness and excitement. He made a questioning gesture toward the pyramid, trying to ask if she knew what it might be. But she did not understand him, or perhaps she knew, but knew as well how impossible it would be to explain its purpose. She made that happy, fluttery motion with her hand again, indicating the table with its load of gadgets, and she seemed to try to laugh. There was, at least, a sense of laughter in her face. Just a kid, Enoch told himself, with a box heaped high with new and wondrous toys. Was that all it was to her? Was she happy and excited merely because she suddenly had become aware of all the beauty and the novelty of the things stacked there on the table? He turned wearily and went back to the desk. He picked up the rifle and hung it on the pegs. She should not be in the station. No human being other than himself should ever be inside the station. Bringing her here, he had broken that unspoken understanding he had with the aliens who had installed him as a keeper. Although, of all the humans he could have brought, Lucy was the one who could possibly be exempt from the understood restriction, for she could never tell the things that she had seen. She could not remain, he knew. She must be taken home. For if she were not taken, there would be a massive hunt for her, a lost girl, a beautiful deaf-mute. A story of a missing deaf-mute girl would bring in newspapermen in a day or two. It would be in all the papers and on television and on radio, and the woods would be swarming with hundreds of searchers. Hank Fisher would tell how he'd tried to break into the house and couldn't, and there'd be others who would try to break into the house, and there'd be hell to pay. Enoch sweated, thinking of it. All the years of keeping out of people's way, all the years of being unobtrusive would be for nothing then. This strange house upon a lonely ridge would become a mystery for the world, and a challenge and a target for all the crackpots of the world. He went to the medicine cabinet to get the healing ointment that had been included in the drug packet provided by Galactic Central. He found it and opened the little box. More than half of it remained. He'd used it through the years, but sparingly. There was, in fact, little need to use a great deal of it. He went across the room to where Lucy sat and stood back of the sofa. He showed her what he had and made motions to show her what it was for. She slid her dress off her shoulders, and he bent to look at the slashes. The bleeding had stopped, but the flesh was red and angry. Gently, he rubbed ointment into the stripes that the whip had made. She had healed the butterfly, he thought, but she could not heal herself. On the table in front of her, the pyramid of spheres still was flashing and glinting, throwing a flickering shadow of color all about the room. It was operating, but what could it be doing? It was finally operating, but not a thing was happening as a result of that operation. Chapter 19. Ulysses came as twilight was deepening into night. Enoch and Lucy had just finished with their supper and were sitting at the table when Enoch heard his footsteps. The alien stood in shadow, and he looked, Enoch thought, more than ever like the cruel clown. His lithe, flowing body had the look of smoked, tanned buckskin. The patchwork color of his hide seemed to shine with a faint luminescence, and the sharp, hard angles of his face, the smooth baldness of his head, the flat, pointed ears pasted tight against the skull, lent him a vicious fearsomeness. If one did not know him for the gentle character that he was, Enoch told himself, he would be enough to scare a man out of 7 years of growth. "We had been expecting you," said Enoch. "The coffee pot is boiling." Ulysses took a slow step forward, then paused.
"You have another with you. A human, I would say."
"There is no danger," Enoch told him.
"Of another gender? A female, is it not? You have found a mate?"
"No," said Enoch. "She is not my mate."
"You have acted wisely through the years," Ulysses told him. "In a position such as yours, a mate is not the best."
You need not worry. There is a malady upon her. She has no communication. She can neither hear nor speak.
A malady?
Yes, from the moment she was born. She has never heard or spoken. She can tell of nothing here.
Sign language?
She knows no sign language. She refused to learn it.
She is a friend of yours.
For some years, said Enoch. She came seeking my protection. Her father used a whip to beat her.
This father knows she's here?
He thinks she is, but he cannot know. Ulysses came slowly out of the darkness and stood within the light. Lucy was watching him, but there was no terror on her face. Her eyes were level and untroubled, and she did not flinch.
She takes me well, Ulysses said. She does not run or scream.
She could not scream, said Enoch, even if she wished.
I must be most repugnant, Ulysses said, at first sight to any human.
She does not see the outside only. She sees inside of you as well.
Would she be frightened if I made a human bow to her?
I think, said Enoch, she might be very pleased. Ulysses made his bow, formal and exaggerated, with one hand upon his leathery belly, bowing from the waist. Lucy smiled and clapped her hands.
You see? Ulysses cried, delighted. I think that she may like me.
Why don't you sit down, then, suggested Enoch, and we all will have some coffee.
I had forgotten of the coffee. The sight of this other human drove coffee from my mind.
He sat down at the place where the third cup had been set and waiting for him. Enoch started around the table, but Lucy rose and went to get the coffee.
She understands? Ulysses asked.
Enoch shook his head. You sat down by the cup, and the cup was empty. She poured the coffee, then went over to the sofa.
She will not stay with us? Ulysses asked.
She's intrigued by that table full of trinkets. She set one of them to going.
You plan to keep her here?
I can't keep her, Enoch said. There will be a hunt for her. I'll have to take her home.
I do not like it, Ulysses said.
Nor do I. Let's admit at once that I should not have brought her here. But at the time, it seemed the only thing to do. I had no time to think it out.
You've done no wrong, said Ulysses softly.
She cannot harm us, said Enoch. Without communication.
It's not that, Ulysses told him. She's just a complication, and I do not like further complications. I came tonight to tell you, Enoch, that we are in trouble.
Trouble? But there's not been any trouble.
Ulysses lifted his coffee cup and took a long drink of it. That is good, he said. I carry back the bean and make it at my home, but it does not taste the same.
This trouble?
You remember the Vagan that died here several of your years ago?
Enoch nodded. The Hazer.
The being has a proper name.
Enoch laughed. You don't like our nicknames.
It is not our way, Ulysses said.
My name for them, said Enoch, is a mark of my affection.
You buried this Vagan.
In my family plot, said Enoch, as if he were my own. I read a verse above him.
That is well and good, Ulysses said.
That is as it should be. You did very well. But the body is gone.
Gone?
It can't be gone, cried Enoch.
It has been taken from the grave.
But you can't know, protested Enoch. How could you know?
Not I. It's the Vagans. The Vagans are the ones who know.
But they're light years distant. And then he was not too sure. For on that night the wise old one had died, and he'd messaged Galactic Central. He had been told that the Vagans had known the moment he had died. And there had been no need for a death certificate, for they knew of what he died. It seemed impossible, of course, but there were too many impossibilities in the galaxy which turned out, after all, to be entirely possible for a man to ever know when he stood on solid ground. Was it possible, he wondered, that each Vagan had some sort of mental contact with every other Vagan? Or that some central census bureau, to give a human designation to something that was scarcely understandable, might have some sort of official linkage with every living Vegan, knowing where it was and how it was and what it might be doing. Something of the sort, Enoch admitted, might indeed be possible. It was not beyond the astounding capabilities that one found on every hand throughout the galaxy. But to maintain a similar contact with the Vegan dead was something else again. "The body's gone," Ulysses said. "I can tell you that, and know it is the truth. You're held accountable."
"By the Vegans?"
"By the Vegans, yes. And the galaxy."
"I did what I could," said Enoch, hotly. "I did what was required. I filled the letter of the Vegan law. I paid the dead my honor and the honor of my planet. It is not right that the responsibility should go on forever. Not that I can believe the body can be really gone. There is no one who would take it. No one who knew of it."
"By human logic," Ulysses told him, "you, of course, are right. But not by Vegan logic. And in this case, Galactic Central would tend to support the Vegans."
"The Vegans," Enoch said testily, "happen to be friends of mine. I have never met a one of them that I didn't like or couldn't get along with. I can work it out with them."
"If only the Vegans were concerned," said Ulysses, "I am quite sure you could." "I would have no worry. But the situation gets complicated as you go along. On the surface, it seems a rather simple happening, but there are many factors. The Vegans, for example, have known for some time that the body had been taken, and they were disturbed, of course. But out of certain considerations, they had kept their silence."
"They needn't have. They could have come to me. I don't know what could have been done."
"Silent not because of you, because of something else." Ulysses finished off his coffee and poured himself another cup. He filled Enoch's half-filled cup and set the pot aside. Enoch waited. "You may not have been aware of it," said Ulysses, "but at the time this station was established, there was considerable opposition to it from a number of races in the galaxy. There were many reasons cited, as is the case in all such situations, but the underlying reason, when you get down to basics, rests squarely on the continual contest for racial or regional advantage. A situation akin, I would imagine, to the continual bickering and maneuvering which you find here upon the Earth to gain an economic advantage for one group or another, or one nation and another. In the galaxy, of course, the economic considerations only occasionally are the underlying factors. There are many other factors than the economic." Enoch nodded. "I had gained a hint of this, nothing recently, but I hadn't paid too much attention to it."
"It's largely a matter of direction," Ulysses said. "When Galactic Central began its expansion into this spiral arm, it meant there was no time or effort available for expansions in other directions. There is one large group of races which has held a dream for many centuries of expanding into some of the nearby globular clusters. It does make a dim sort of sense, of course, with the techniques that we have. The longer jump across space to some of the closer clusters is entirely possible. Another thing, the clusters seem to be extraordinarily free of dust and gas, so that once we got there we could expand more rapidly throughout the cluster than we can in many parts of the galaxy. But at best, it's a speculative business, for we don't know what we'll find there."
"After we've made all the effort and spent all the time, we may find little or nothing, except possibly some more real estate, and we have plenty of that in the galaxy. But the clusters have a vast appeal for certain types of minds."
Enoch nodded. "I can see that. It would be the first venturing out of the galaxy itself. It might be the first short step on the route that could lead us to other galaxies."
Ulysses peered at him. "You too," he said. "I might have known." Enoch said smugly, "I am that type of mind. Well, anyhow, there was this globular cluster faction, I suppose you'd call it that, which contended bitterly when we began our move in this direction. You understand, certainly you do, that we've barely begun the expansion into this neighborhood. We have less than a dozen stations, and we'll need 100. It will take centuries before the network is complete."
"So, this faction is still contending," Enoch said. "There is still time to stop this spiral arm project."
"That is right. And that's what worries me. for the faction is set to use this incident of the missing body as an emotion-charged argument against the extension of this network. It is being joined by other groups that are concerned with certain special interests, and these special interest groups see a better chance of getting what they want if they can wreck this project.
Wreck it?
Yes, wreck it. They will start screaming as soon as the body incident becomes open knowledge that a planet so barbaric as the Earth is no fit location for a station. They will insist that this station be abandoned.
But they can't do that.
They can, Ulysses said. They will say it is degrading and unsafe to maintain a station so barbaric that even graves are rifled, on a planet where the honored dead cannot rest in peace. It is the kind of highly emotional argument that will gain wide acceptance and support in some sections of the galaxy. The Vegans tried their best. They tried to hush it up for the sake of the project. They have never done a thing like that before. They are a proud people, and they feel a slight to honor, perhaps more deeply than many other races. And yet, for the greater good, they were willing to accept dishonor, and would have if they could have kept it quiet. But the story leaked out somehow, by good espionage, no doubt, and they cannot stand the loss of face in advertised dishonor. The Vegan, who will be arriving here this evening, is an official representative charged with delivering an official protest.
To me?
To you, and through you, to the Earth.
But the Earth is not concerned. The Earth doesn't even know.
Of course it doesn't. So far as Galactic Central is concerned, you are the Earth. You represent the Earth. Enoch shook his head. It was a crazy way of thinking, but he told himself he should not be surprised. It was the kind of thinking he should have expected. He was too hidebound, he thought, too narrow. He had been trained in the human way of thinking, and even after all these years, that way of thought persisted. Persisted to a point where any way of thought that conflicted with it must automatically seem wrong. This talk of abandoning Earth Station was wrong, too. It made no sort of sense, for abandoning of the station would not wreck the project, although, more than likely, it would wreck whatever hope he'd held for the human race.
But even if you have to abandon Earth, he said, you could go out to Mars. You could build a station there. If it's necessary to have a station in this solar system, there are other planets.
You don't understand, Ulysses told him. This station is just one point of attack. It is no more than a toehold, just a bare beginning. The aim is to wreck the project, to free the time and effort that is expended here for some other project. If they can force us to abandon one station, then we stand discredited. Then all our motives and our judgment come up for review.
But even if the project should be wrecked, Enoch pointed out, there is no surety that any group would gain. It would only throw the question of where the time and energy should be used into an open debate. You say that there are many special interest factions banding together to carry on the fight against us. Suppose that they do win. Then they must turn around and start fighting among themselves.
Of course that is the case, Ulysses admitted. But then each of them has a chance to get what they want, or think they have a chance. The way it is, they have no chance at all. Before any of them has a chance, this project must go down the drain. There is one group on the far side of the galaxy that wants to move out into the thinly populated sections of one particular section of the rim. They still believe in an ancient legend which says that their race arose as the result of immigrants from another galaxy who landed on the rim and worked their way inward over many galactic years. They think that if they can get out to the rim, they can turn that legend into history to their greater glory. Another group wants to go into a small spiral arm because of an obscure record that many eons ago their ancestors picked up some virtually undecipherable messages which they believed came from that direction. Through the years, the story has grown, until today they are convinced a race of intellectual giants will be found in that spiral arm, and there is always the pressure, naturally, to probe deeper into the galactic core. You must realize that we have only started, that the galaxy still is largely unexplored, that the thousands of races who form Galactic Central still are pioneers, and as a result, Galactic Central is continually subjected to all sorts of pressures.
You sound, said Enoch,
as if you have little hope of maintaining this station here on Earth.
Almost no hope at all, Ulysses told him. But so far as you yourself are concerned, there will be an option. You can stay here and live out an ordinary life on Earth, or you can be assigned to another station. Galactic Central hopes that you would elect to continue on with us.
That sounds pretty final.
I am afraid, Ulysses said, it is. I am sorry, Enoch, to be the bearer of bad news.
Enoch sat numb and stricken. Bad news? It was worse than that. It was the end of everything. He sensed the crashing down of not only his own personal world, but of all the hopes of Earth. With the station gone, Earth once more will be left in the backwaters of the galaxy, with no hope of help, no chance of recognition, no realization of what lay waiting in the galaxy. Standing alone and naked, the human race would go on in its same old path, fumbling its uncertain way toward a blind, mad future.
Chapter 20.
The hazer was elderly. The golden haze that enveloped him had lost the sparkle of its youthfulness. It was a mellow glow, deep and rich, not the blinding haze of a younger being. He carried himself with a solid dignity, and the flaring top knot that was neither hair nor feathers was white, a sort of saintly whiteness. His face was soft and tender, the softness and the tenderness which in a man might have been expressed in kindly wrinkles.
"I am sorry," he told Enoch, "that our meeting must be such as this, although, under any circumstances, I am glad to meet you. I have heard of you. It is not often that a being of an outside planet is the keeper of a station. Because of this, young being, I have been intrigued with you. I have wondered what sort of creature you might turn out to be."
"You need have no apprehension of him," Ulysses said, a little sharply. "I will vouch for him. We have been friends for years."
"Yes, I forgot," the hazer said. "You are his discoverer."
He peered around the room.
"Another one," he said. "I did not know there were two of them. I only knew of one."
"It's a friend of Enoch's," Ulysses said.
"There has been contact, then. Contact with the planet."
"No, there has been no contact."
"Perhaps an indiscretion."
"Perhaps," Ulysses said, "but under provocation that I doubt either you or I could have stood against."
Lucy had risen to her feet, and now she came across the room, moving quietly and slowly, as if she might be floating. The hazer spoke to her in the common tongue.
"I am glad to meet you, very glad to meet you."
"She cannot speak," Ulysses said, "nor hear. She has no communication."
"Compensation," said the hazer.
"You think so?"
asked Ulysses.
"I am sure of it."
He walked slowly forward, and Lucy waited.
She, the female form, you called it, she is not afraid."
Ulysses chuckled.
"Not even of me," he said.
The hazer reached out his hand to her, and she stood quietly for a moment. Then one of her hands came up and took the hazer's fingers, more like tentacles than fingers, in its grasp. It seemed to Enoch, for a moment, that the cloak of golden haze reached out to wrap the Earth girl in its glow. Enoch blinked his eyes, and the illusion, if it had been illusion, was swept away, and it only was the hazer who had the golden cloak. And how was it, Enoch wondered, that there was no fear in her, either of Ulysses or the hazer? Was it because, in truth, as he had said, she could see beyond the outward guise, could somehow sense the basic humanity? God help me, I cannot think even now except in human terms, that was in these creatures? And if that were true, was it because she herself was not entirely human? A human, certainly in form and origin, but not formed and molded into the human culture, being perhaps what a human would be if he were not hemmed about so closely by the rules of behavior and outlook that through the years had hardened into law to comprise a common human attitude. Lucy dropped the hazer's hand and went back to the sofa. The hazer said,
Enoch Wallace.
Yes?
She is of your race.
Yes, of course she is.
She is most unlike you, almost as if there were two races.
There is not two races. There is only one.
Are there many others like her?
I would not know, said Enoch. Coffee, said Ulysses to the hazer.
Would you like some coffee?
Coffee.
A most delicious brew, Earth's one great accomplishment.
I am not acquainted with it,
said the hazer. I don't believe I will.
He turned ponderously to Enoch.
You know why I am here,
he asked. I believe so.
It is a matter I regret, said the hazer. But I must.
If you'd rather, Enoch said, we can consider that the protest has been made. I would so stipulate.
Why not? Ulysses said. There is no need, it seems to me, to have the three of us go through a somewhat painful scene.
The hazer hesitated.
If you feel you must, said Enoch.
No,
the hazer said.
I am satisfied if an unspoken protest be generously accepted.
Accepted, Enoch said, on just one condition, that I satisfy myself that the charge is not unfounded. I must go out and see.
You do not believe me?
It is not a matter of belief. It is something that can be checked. I cannot accept either for myself or for my planet until I have done that much.
Enoch, Ulysses said, the Vegan has been gracious, not only now, but before this happened. His race presses the charge most reluctantly. They suffered much to protect the Earth and you.
And the feeling is that I would be ungracious if I did not accept the protest and the charge on the Vegan statement.
I am sorry, Enoch, said Ulysses. That is what I mean.
Enoch shook his head. For years, I've tried to understand and to conform to the ethics and ideas of all the people who have come through this station. I've pushed my own human instincts and training to one side. I've tried to understand other viewpoints and to evaluate other ways of thinking, many of which did violence to my own. I am glad of all of it, for it has given me a chance to go beyond the narrowness of Earth. I think I gained something from it all. But none of this touched Earth. Only myself was involved. This business touches Earth, and I must approach it from an Earthman's viewpoint. In this particular instance, I am not simply the keeper of a galactic station. Neither of them said a word. Enoch stood waiting, and still there was nothing said. Finally, he turned and headed for the door. I'll be back, he told them. He spoke the phrase, and the door started to slide open.
If you'll have me, said the hazer quietly. I'd like to go with you.
Fine, said Enoch. Come ahead. It was dark outside, and Enoch lit the lantern. The hazer watched him closely. Fossil fuel, Enoch told him. It burns at the tip of a saturated wick. The hazer said, in horror,
But surely you have better.
Much better now, said Enoch. I am just old-fashioned. He led the way outside, the lantern throwing a small pool of light. The hazer followed.
It is a wild planet, said the hazer.
Wild here. There are parts of it are tame.
My own planet is controlled, the hazer said. Every foot of it is planned.
I know. I have talked to many Vegans. They described the planet to me. They headed for the barn. You want to go back? Asked Enoch.
No, said the hazer. I find it exhilarating. Those are wild plants over there?
We call them trees, said Enoch.
The wind blows as it wishes?
That's right, said Enoch. We do not know as yet how to control the weather. The spade stood just inside the barn door, and Enoch picked it up. He headed for the orchard.
You know, of course, the hazer said. The body will be gone.
I'm prepared to find it gone.
Then why?
the Hazer asked. Because I must be sure. You can't understand that, can you?
You said back there in the station, the Hazer said, that you tried to understand the rest of us. Perhaps for a change, at least one of us should try understanding you.
Enoch led the way down the path through the orchard. They came to the rude fence enclosing the burial plot. The sagging gate stood open. Enoch went through it, and the Hazer followed.
This is where you buried him.
This is my family plot. My mother and father are here, and I put him with them. He handed the lantern to the Vegan, and, armed with the spade, walked up to the grave. He thrust the spade into the ground. Would you hold the lantern a little closer, please? The Hazer moved up a step or two. Enoch dropped to his knees and brushed away the leaves that had fallen on the ground. Underneath them was the soft, fresh earth that had been newly turned. There was a depression and a small hole at the bottom of the depression. As he brushed at the earth, he could hear the clods of displaced dirt falling through the hole and striking on something that was not the soil. The Hazer had moved the lantern again, and he could not see. But he did not need to see. He knew there was no use of digging. He knew what he would find. He should have kept watch. He should not have put up the stone to attract attention, but Galactic Central had said, as if he were your own. And that was the way he'd done it. He straightened, but remained upon his knees, felt the damp of the earth soaking through the fabric of his trousers.
No one told me, said the Hazer, speaking softly.
Told you what?
The memorial, and what is written on it. I was not aware that you knew our language.
I learned it long ago. There were scrolls I wished to read. I'm afraid it's not too good.
Two misspelled words, the Hazer told him, and one little awkwardness. But those are things which do not matter. What matters, and matters very much, is that when you wrote, you thought as one of us.